Chapter 6. The fires of distant campsites flickered to life across the landscape as Vetchel's refugees made camp. From the boulder that Haraldin reclined on, they looked like earthbound stars spread across the vast expanse of the plain.
"I'm not saying that I don't feel bad for those people," Haraldin told Geist. "I'm not heartless. But you have to admit, Vetchel's folk are doing fine given the circumstances. They must have kept up on their evacuation drills."
The weapons master, standing stoically next to Haraldin's perch, allowed a hint of a nod in agreement. The cities of Arth had become accustomed to invasion by the forces of darkness. Indeed, much of the world's economy depended on the periodic sacking of major cities by monstrous threats. Natural selection had long ago eliminated those citizens who weren't prepared to evacuate on short notice. Vacating an entire city was considered an essential skill among Arth's populace, and the people of Vetchel made retreat an art form. Within an hour of the alarm bells sounding, the streets had been lined with people methodically loading children, provisions, and supplies onto wagons and pack animals. Now that the party was 3 days out of the city, Haraldin was confident Vetchel was empty. "But as they say in Dalen, sometimes life is like a sewer flood. It stinks, but it only gets worse if you go against the current. And this party is headed upstream without a paddle." Geist's expression might have been concerned, or perhaps taken aback. The weapons master was harder to read than a blank book, but Haraldin liked to think that he had become quite adept at interpreting Geist's subtle cues. If the bard had overestimated the degree of insight he had into Geist's silence, the weapons master never corrected him. At least Haraldin didn't think he had.
"Don't be so surprised, my friend," Haraldin said. "I may seem a hopeless romantic at times, but I'm a firm pragmatist at heart."
Haraldin was almost certain he saw Geist roll his eyes as the weapons master leaned down to pull a thrones board from his rucksack.
"It's a common mistake."
Haraldin clambered down from the boulder as Geist placed the board on a rock between them. "People see that I am a lover of song, of poetry, of nature, of love itself. They assume that because I have such an artful soul, I must be led by my heart. But above all, I am a lover of life. Mine, specifically. And as such, I rely on my wits and intellect to preserve it as long as possible."
Geist's scarf rippled with a hint of a smirk as he tapped the side of the thrones board. They'd both carved a notch in the oak slab for each of their wins over the past year. Haraldin had a few scattered grooves on his side of the board, while Geist's edge looked like it had been vigorously gnawed on by some needle-toothed animal.
"Oh, very amusing," said Haraldin, setting up his pieces. He elected to play as white this game, but as they'd resorted to scrounging improvised pieces, he was actually playing as white, light gray, brownish, sky blue, and a piece of quartz.
"I'll concede that you've a knack for thrones. And you're a sound strategist as well."
Haraldin opened the game by advancing a bannerman.
"But you know I lived on the streets for years. I've a knack for self-preservation, which is why I know this plan is madness."
Geist moved his own bannerman forward.
"You can pretend you don't see it if you like, friend."
Haraldin quickly moved another bannerman, then put a knight into play when Geist countered. "But I know you have the same questions that I do. Why did we spend a year chasing the Red Horde across the Freedlands? Why did we stroll into a city with the Heroes Guild calling for our heads? Why are we off to rob said guild now, just so we can fight a lich? Do we gain anything, or are we just wandering in search of misery to interfere with?"
Geist didn't look up from the board as he made a move, a bold rush with his solomancer to take a bannerman.
"Well, it may not matter to you, but I can think of a few better ways to live in exile. Most of them involve hard drink and loose women." Haraldin took the solomancer with a knight and cursed as he realized he'd left his noctomancer exposed in his haste. "But it seems everyone else is hell-bent on diving headfirst into peril until we die."
Geist shrugged and advanced his own noctomancer, pinning Haraldin's. With only one safe move, the bard's noctomancer flipped to Geist's side.
"Ah, right. I forgot that you're chief among those determined to fall in combat," said Haraldin, taking the turncoat noctomancer with a bannerman.
I wonder, my friend, what could drive you to want your own end? Is it for guilt or grief? Or do you wish to die for honor, as you Imperials are so prone to?
The weapons master's eyes flashed with uncharacteristic emotion as they snapped up to look directly into Heraldon's. It was practically a shout by Geist's standards.
Easy, friend, said the bard, holding his hands up. I meant no disrespect, merely amusing.
Geist stared at him for a moment, then turned back to the game. For a while they played in true silence, their faces as still as the evening air, their attacks and counters accelerating as the game intensified.
You know, Heraldon said as he took a knight, I'm reminded of a Tinderkin legend that a tinker's daughter once taught me.
Geist pulled back a bannerman without looking up.
She said that when Arth was young and the gods still roamed it, Gnome ran in the forest with deer and boar and wolf and all the other animals. Gnome hunted, and he fought, and he killed. He lived with no thought for any other, just as deer and boar and wolf did.
Heraldon fainted with his solomancer, then took the knight that Geist sent after it. Geist's brow furrowed.
But Gnome roamed too far, hunted too much, killed too many. This displeased Fengeld, the lady in the wood, and she was no longer content to have him run among her beasts, so she sent wolf and dog to hunt Gnome and kill him.
Heraldon traded a bannerman for a knight.
Wolf and dog chased Gnome across all of Arth, and Gnome thought that he would die, for wolf and dog were mightier than he. But Arrow, the Hearthfather, had pity. The god came to Gnome and gave him a mask, so that when dog and wolf caught Gnome, they didn't recognize him.
Most of the pieces were gone now, and the action was centered around a corner of the board where Heraldon's knight was dancing with Geist's Noctomancer and King.
Dog said, We've come to kill a beast called Gnome, said Heraldon. But Gnome pointed to his mask and replied, I am no beast, I am man. I have morals and nobility and honor. It is much better than being a beast. And Dog believed Gnome, and so abandoned Fengeld and went with Gnome as his companion.
Geist narrowed his eyes at Heraldon as he pulled back his king.
But Wolf was angry, and he told Dog, Gnome has not changed. Man is only a mask on a beast. If you take his mask away, he will fight and kill as much as ever. I will not be shackled by his lies. And so Wolf ran back to Fengeld, to be free and run with the beasts forever.
Heraldon pressed in with his knight and a bannerman, forcing Geist's pieces against the edge of the board. The weapons master furrowed his brow and moved a distant knight toward the fray. Heraldon pressed in.
People may play at morals, or nobility, or honor. They may believe in the right thing, so much that they'd even fight a lich to save a bunch of people they've never met. But in times of hardship, or war, or famine, times that are coming soon, the mask falls, and all the honorable things slip away. They are not real. They are not worth giving your life for. Especially not when you would leave behind friends sorry to see you go.
Geist froze for a moment, his eyes locked on the board. Then, slowly, purposefully, he advanced a knight. It was a mistake. Heraldon swiftly captured the knight and pointed it at Geist.
I'm stuck on this so-called quest, friend, a caged animal. With the guild and Benny Hookhand after my blood, I've no chance of making it on my own. But with a fighter like you, well, should you ever drop the mask, you and I could run free again. Think on that.
The bard advanced his last bannerman, pinning Geist's Noctomancer and turning it to his side. Geist's king had no moves left.
I believe that's a win for me, he told the weapons master standing, and I know enough to quit when I'm ahead. Have a good evening, my friend.
With that, Heraldon headed back to the tents and left Geist to pick up the pieces.
I bet that hurt,
said Ignatius Whithelm, but he stared at the shrine's eyes for another second before he allowed himself a laugh.
These days being a priest of the god of death wasn't as much fun as it used to be.
It took an odd sort to serve in the priesthood of Mordo Og. The Lord of the End had few followers and no treasury. He rarely afforded his clergy power and bestowed few rewards on them for their devotion.
And when a priest finally arrived at their own end, all of Mordo Og's scant teachings were clear. There was no special treatment for his disciples. Then again, the god of death demanded little of his followers, and people asked even less of them. And while the majority of people went all their lives ignoring most of the pantheon, all of them bowed to Mordo Og at least once. Ignatius was odder than most of his brothers and sisters in service. Most of Mordo Og's clergy were maudlin, spending their days moping around in white makeup and black robes while they recited tragic sonnets. But Ignatius considered himself a romantic, a lover of life. Most specifically, the last bit. He took immense pleasure from watching people the world over pass away, their departing souls momentarily lighting the eyes of the shrine of Mordo Og in Sculpin Down.
There goes another!
The shrine was little more than a single statue carved into an alcove in Andoran's wall. It depicted a seated skeleton with steepled hands. Crimson light flashed intermittently in the skull's sockets, and with every flicker, the old priest's gap-toothed grin grew.
And another! Guess the herdsman finally bought the farm, eh? Ha ha! And...
The old priest stopped short as the lights in the skull changed in nature, shifting in hue from crimson to a pale, sickly green that lingered even after the flare of light had faded. The worshippers of Mordo Og had few tenets, but they took what they had seriously. Their chief creed said that death was a journey all mortals must make, and it should be a one-way trip. Ignatius knew all too well the blasphemy portended by a flash of viridescent light.
No!
The priest howled, hurling himself against the statue's dark eye sockets as though he could claw the light within them back into being.
You stay down! That isn't right!
The red light resumed flickering, as constant and passionless as ever.
The master hates that,
he muttered, pulling himself back. He pulled his black robes around himself as though warding off a chill.
And there's too much of it these days. It isn't right for the dead to walk. It isn't right.
It's all sodding drake spit!
A sweep of Tyrann Urthos's arm swept the clutter from his desk, including his tumbler of dwarven whiskey. It made a sad chiming sound as it shattered. Tyrann stared at the glass shards and amber liquid pooled beneath them on the wooden floor. Part of him worried that the liquid would stain the floorboards, but then the sober part recalled that it didn't matter. Nobody would care about the floor in the morning. The guardhouse likely wouldn't be here by morning. With a shrug, Tyrann poured himself another glass of Burn Bristle's gold label, aged 400 years. He had taken the first drink to calm his nerves and steady his hands, but by now the alcohol had pushed him long past steadiness into fluid wobbling. Yet what the burning liquor took away in stability, it gave back in confidence, and by the time he had drained his latest glass, the letter seemed like a good idea again. He retrieved it from the pile of papers on the floor. At first he thought his drink must have spilled on the page, as all the writing looked blurry and smudged, but then he decided that the rest of the room looked rather blurry and smudged as well. With a shrug, he folded the missive and fetched a red candle. Wax dribbled all over the parchment as he waved the candle with the exaggerated concentration of a drunk. It took him 4 tries to finally hit a crimson pool with his signet ring and seal the letter. As he shook the letter to cool the wax, his eye caught the small framed woodcut of 3 smiling figures sitting in a meadow in their best dress. In the hills behind them, the Urthos family castle sat on Ruskin's northern shore. The ancestral hold was usually cold and miserable, but for a few weeks each summer, the snow melted, the flowers bloomed, and the hills came alive. Little Aubie had loved running in the coastal meadows. Tyrann's younger self grinned back at him from the picture, blissfully unaware that the woman at his side would be running off with a bard from Perrald the next winter, taking Aubie with her. Years later, Tyrann was still alone, still miserable, and living under a de facto death sentence. The impending doom was a recent development, and one that he blamed himself for. Tyrann was familiar enough with Nove's principles of universal irony to know that claiming a portion of the undead's treasure was just begging for trouble. The universe would never allow Tyran such good fortune. Nor fate, nor the gods, nor most pointedly the elders of Vetchel. Elder Thistle had taken particular delight in assigning the Knight Commander to defend Vetchel to the last. Tyran took a deep breath and poured himself a final drink. To the pit with Elder Thistle, he said in a toast, and with Nove, and with the whole thrice-cursed universe while we're at it. Another thought struck him as he drained the glass. He made a couple of clumsy attempts to open the panel on the back of the picture. Failing that, he smashed the frame on his desk, slipped the woodcut into his belt pouch, and stood up. Standing was a bad idea. His office spun with such violence that he nearly fell to the floor. Between the liquor and the ceremonial armor, Tyran couldn't manage much beyond an exaggerated stagger. He fell against the door, took a few deep breaths, and threw it open. "Knight Commander!" Captains and sergeants charged Tyran the moment he emerged from his office. "Knight Commander Urthos, the undead are at the southern gate! The bloody corpses are scaling the walls! Skeletal archers are letting loose, reported several casualties, wards over the east wall!" Tyran raised a hand to silence the assembled officers, but doing so threw him off balance. It was all he could do to catch himself by leaning against the wall at a 45-degree angle. "Fellows, I appreciate your troubles, but I regret to inform you that I am resigning, effective immediately," he said to the floor, waving the letter in the general direction of the closest subordinates. "What?" demanded Captain Bothwick. "I am resigning, effective—" "We heard what you said," said Captain Ingram. "But it cannot be so, sir. You can't abandon the men now, when they need you most." "Well, I can't see how they need me," said Tyran. "I can't save their lives, and they'll surely manage to die without my help."
"But we're to be the town's rear guard," protested Sergeant Araston.
"We're here to mount a facade of a defense so the citizens' insurance policies don't get voided," snarled Tyran. "If the town has no defenders, all of these houses are abandoned property. Some token soldiers have to be sacrificed. I don't intend to be among them."
"Give up your hopeless cynicism, man," snapped Captain Bothwick. "We're buying the evacuees time to flee."
"Maybe you are," said Tyran. "I'm here because I submitted the quest." The assembled officers looked aghast.
"Do you care nothing for the people of our city?" demanded one of them.
The fat one, Tyran couldn't think of his name.
"They got a good head start."
Tyran walked his hands up the wall to right himself. Magda and Abby left 11 years ago. The rest of them had, what, 4 days? Good enough.
"What you're proposing, Knight Commander, is dereliction of duty," growled Captain Ingram.
"I can't have any duty because I'm a deserter," said Tyran, throwing the letter at the captain's feet. Slowly, trying to disguise his unsteady gait as a purposeful stride, Tyran pushed past the gathered officers and out the door.
"So that's it," Bothwick said. "We're all to die here, abandoned by our commanding officer."
"You might be, but I'm headed north." Tyran pointed down the road in front of him.
"Should we arrest him, sirs?" asked Sergeant Araston.
"No," said Captain Ingram, wearing a strange smile.
"No, leave him. He'll get his soon enough."
Tyran staggered on his way as fast as his legs would carry him. His progress was slow, as the street kept spinning when he moved, and nothing looked like it was in the right place. He staggered down side streets and got sidetracked in alleys as he searched for some familiar signs, but everything seemed off. Worse, the sounds of fighting were intensifying around him. When Tyran stumbled around a corner and saw the wall, his stomach fell. Soldiers were crowded up against Vetchel's massive gate, and many more lined the ramparts. Spectres clashed against magical wards that the mages had left over the city. The way the enchanted barriers shimmered and shook with every ghostly assault led Tyran to believe the magic wouldn't hold much longer.
"You there!"
he shouted, stumbling up to a soldier at the rear of the mob. "Have the undead made it this far north?"
"North?"
said the startled soldier.
"I suppose so, yes, lordship. They arrived at the gates this morning."
"And are you all deserters?" asked Tyran.
"Not at all, Knight Commander," said the soldier.
He looked to be a lieutenant by the stripes above his heraldry, a middle-aged man by the gray in his hair and paunch sticking out from beneath his breastplate.
"Not while I have a sword on my belt and a spear in my hand."
"But then, Two of Tyran's neurons finally swam close enough to make the connection.
Oh, thrice curse the god's bones! This is the southern gate!
Of course, your lordship, said the lieutenant. The last stand of Vetchel.
It occurred to Tyran that there was a fatal flaw in his plan. By the time he had imbibed enough courage to brazenly desert, he was too drunk to navigate to safety. He shook his head.
I can't be. I mean, I've got to... I need to...
The Knight Commander found it hard to form a sentence with a pickled brain and a strange piping in his ears.
Got to... Do you hear something?
Battles are generally a noisy affair, sir, said the lieutenant. Screams, clanging weapons, and... What is that?
Amid the roar of battle, Tyran could make out warbling music, growing in volume and intensity.
Is that music?
Asked the lieutenant. The other soldiers looked around in bewilderment as a stream of short, sharp notes overwhelmed the battle, punctuated by a longer, deeper swell of music. At the bottom of his depths, Tyran wanted to run. Unfortunately, the rest of his depths were already running about 80 proof. Now that he had lost his momentum, he doubted he could take more than a few steps without toppling over.
It's one of them gnomish organs,
shouted another man at the barricade.
Stop talking nonsense, the lieutenant hollered back. Of course it ain't a gnomish organ.
A siege engine of some sort or another hit the wall, sending a cloud of stone dust into the air. Chips of masonry and ashes rained down on the resolute guards below. Sheets of paper fluttered over the wall like pale leaves among the fog. Tyran snatched one from the air and read with bleary eyes. The page was a flyer, like the ones the general store used to sell adventuring gear. A single skull woodcut decorated the top, and beneath it a bold message was printed in equally bold lettering of various sizes. Tremble, mortal! Dread Lord Dutar Ermion, King of the Dead, comes for your soul. Eternal torment awaits. Tyran looked up from the page to see if anyone else had seen the odd advertisement. He noticed a couple of soldiers exchanging nervous glances as they read. Most of the guards were standing resolute to the last, and two of them, inexplicably, were still locked in debate.
Now I'm certain of it, Ted,
the soldier insisted.
Listen to those staccato notes, the fugues. It's one of those imperial toccata pieces, and imperial toccatas were traditionally written to be played on gnomish organs. Don't you lecture me on imperial toccatas, netted beggins, snapped the lieutenant. This ain't about music theory. It's about supply lines and efficiency.
This isn't really the time. Tyran stumbled back from the gate. Whatever the instrument, the music was getting louder and rushing toward an imposing crescendo.
I mean, even a small gnomish organ has got to weigh over 300 stone, and if you shake it too hard, the insides will get busted,
Lieutenant Ted continued.
Who wants to haul that alongside an army? And then you'd need your regular maintenance to keep the pipes clean and the leather bits from fraying, not to mention keeping it in tune. The logistics would be a nightmare. I can't say anything about logistics, but I know a gnomish organ playing an imperial toccata when I hear one,
Nettard yelled back.
Burn it, Nettard, shouted Ted. Why would anyone haul an extremely heavy yet very fragile instrument hundreds of miles just to play it at the dramatic climax of a siege?
The lieutenant likely would have continued arguing, but the soldiers' debate, and their lives, were cut short by the dramatic climax of the siege. Specifically, the part where the gates of Vetchel were blown from their hinges in a great explosion of shrapnel and surprised guards.
It's called setting the atmosphere, you troglodytes, roared a robed figure emerging from smoke and dust.
He towered above the stricken guards, in part because he was tall, but mostly because he levitated a foot off the ground. A skull burned with violet flames where his head should have been, and he wore a crown wrought from iron spikes. Behind him, ranks of leering corpses shambled into the city. Tyran didn't know much about the undead, but he knew enough to recognize a lich when he saw one. He turned to flee again, but encountering a lich was a prime example of what Heroes Guild auditors referred to as statistical death. Circumstances wherein a person's chances of survival were so near zero that his or her life was, for all intents and purposes, definitively over. Tyrion didn't make it two steps before the math played out. The Lich wove a plume of violet flames with a casual wave of his hand, blasting Tyrion from his feet. As the Knight Commander fell in agony, his belt pouch burst open, and the family woodcut fell into view. A sudden longing washed over him amidst the pain, and he tried to scream Aubie's name, but he couldn't make a sound. The picture curled and blackened to ash in moments, and then Tyrion's world vanished in a flash. Light filled Tyrion's consciousness, narrowing into a circle of brilliant white, and for a moment he felt compelled to walk toward the luminous singularity. Yet longing and anger still filled him, burning hot and weighing heavily. The emotions pulled him backward, downward, and he fell into what seemed like an eternal darkness. In time, the shadows around Tyrion congealed into the charred husks of buildings and heaps of rubble. He clutched at the ground and froze when his fingers hit the cobbles with a cold click rather than the familiar pressure of flesh on stone. He turned his gauntlet over, and through blackened holes in his chainmail, he saw that his hand was gone, replaced by a skeletal appendage. Confusion gripped him. He turned away from the ghastly sight and immediately leapt to his feet. Not an arm's length from his face, a skull bobbed in the air, surrounded by a cloud of blood-red flames. It stared at Tyrion with a single, lidless eyeball. "What is happening?" Tyrion cried in a voice much like his own, but colder, more flat, distant. "Hello," said the skull. It bobbed up and down in a manner reminiscent of a friendly wave. "You've been selected to be a part of a focus group."
"I just never would have expected that," said Laruna, propping Caitha up on her shoulder as they made their way toward the campsite. "I mean, not with a ranger, anyway."
Caitha grit her teeth as she limped.
"Anyone can trip over a tree root and twist their leg."
"I thought it was a rock," said Laruna.
"I feel like the key point here is my leg," said Caitha.
Camp was still a good distance off, and the road was farther still. The campsites and cookfires of evacuees lined the main route from Vechel to Perrald. The moving city raised a constant din that could be heard from miles away. After days with a grueling pace, Laruna's party had put enough distance between themselves and Vechel's displaced populace to finally hear themselves think. They set up their tents shortly before the sunset, and after dinner there was still enough daylight for some sparring before bed. At least Laruna had presumed there was enough light, but then the elf face-planted in the middle of the field.
"Right, accidents happen,"
Laruna glanced around.
"So, do you need me to heal you?"
No, that's quite all right,"
said Caitha hurriedly.
"Oh, thank the gods."
Spells for mending wounds, curing poisons, and cleansing disease were all part of a typical solomancer's skill set, but Laruna specialized in pyromancy. She'd never been much good for anything in the healing ward, save perhaps cauterizing wounds.
"Maybe I could borrow an elixir, though?"
Caitha suggested.
"A healing potion?"
Laruna looked at the elf's limp.
"I mean, I saw you fall. It didn't seem that serious."
"Right, but as a precaution."
"A precaution against what?"
The mage gave the ranger a sideways glance.
"Infection? Possible breaks?"
Caitha huffed.
"Look, I just thought you might have picked some salve up back in Vechel or something."
"Gods, you sound like..."
Laruna didn't consciously stop herself from saying a salve head. Rather, words failed her, as memories from the past year hijacked her train of thought. The elf's constant scratching of her wrists, Caitha's frequent requests to borrow others' potions, the ranger's habit of staring into the distance, talking softly to herself.
"It might be a sprain, or worse," the elf continued. "I can't do my job if I can't walk, so I..." "Why are you looking at me like that?"
"Looking at you like what?"
said Laruna, trying to look nonchalant.
"You're giving me the you have a problem look, Laruna," said Caitha.
"No, I'm not,"
said Laruna. As an afterthought, she broke into a wide grin. Caitha scowled.
"Don't play games. Every town crier from here to the Imperial City has called me a drunk. I've had more interventions than birthdays, and I'm really old. I know the you have a problem look when I see it, and you're giving me that look.
or you were. Now you're just smiling like you're guilty, or kind of insane.
I never said you had a problem.
Good, said Katha, because I don't have a problem.
Although that is what someone with a problem would say, the Solomancer added.
They stared at each other through narrowed eyes.
Yes, said Katha slowly, but it is also what someone without a problem would say. I mean...
Laruna looked around helplessly. Like most mages, she had spent her life neglecting relationships in favor of bending reality to her will. Now that her circumstances called for diplomacy and tact, she was no more useful than a club in a wizard's duel. There were, Laruna realized, some problems that she couldn't set on fire.
It's just that if, the Solomancer stumbled, if you didn't know you had a problem, or you were in denial about it.
You know what? Katha pulled away from Laruna and hopped a couple of steps away. I don't need this right now. Life is hard enough without my so-called friends second-guessing my injuries. I'll make it back to camp on my own, thanks.
Katha, Laruna called. Katha, I'm sorry.
She started to follow the elf, but stopped short, in part because she had no idea what to say, and in part because the ranger's limp was vanishing as she strode back toward her tent. The Solomancer's hands dropped to her sides. Laruna liked to keep things simple. It was why she loved professional heroics. There wasn't much a hero encountered that couldn't be solved with a liberal application of fireballs. Unfortunately, until recently, that had been her preferred method for solving interpersonal conflict as well. She still had no idea how to peacefully resolve problems with other mages, let alone how to approach an immortal ex-celebrity about a potential drug problem. A thought struck the Solomancer. Gorm was also an ex-celebrity, and while not immortal, he was both older than Laruna and crotchety beyond his years. Plus, he and Katha were close friends. Perhaps he would have some insight. Laruna started walking faster towards the camp. A quick glance around the cook fire confirmed that Gorm hadn't returned to camp yet. Just as Jin lost himself in books, or Heraldin and Geist ceaselessly played thrones, the dwarf escaped the stresses of their travels nearly every night by wandering off into the woods. If memory served, Laruna had seen the dwarf set out for a distant copse of birch and pine. Even at a distance, the small wood looked like the perfect spot for a private conversation about how to handle a potential crisis. Gorm would know what to do. With a nod to herself, the Solomancer turned from camp and set out to find the dwarf.
"Do you even know where you'll search?"
Thane asked.
"Not sure. Aya's papers say who owns the artifacts we need, but not where they're kept."
Gorm sat at the edge of the small creek running through the shallow ravine they occupied, working a whetstone over the edge of his axe.
"First thing is to get to Perrald. After that, we'll see if we can figure out which relic to look for."
"Just one?"
Bert asked. The kobold reclined by the shore on Gorm's rucksack, gnawing on a rabbit bone.
"Aye? And only then because we've no other good choice," said Gorm.
He rinsed his stone and axe in the stream.
"Artifacts are trouble, one and all. And worse, Jin says most of these on Aya's list were made by the Sten. You can't trust anything the Sten touched."
"Who are the Sten?"
said the troll. Gorm looked at the troll. The hulking shadowkin wore a big smile, expectant and naive. It was hard to keep track of the boundaries of Thane's knowledge. He must have been the most eloquent and sophisticated troll on Arth, but that wasn't a high bar to jump, or step over. A wood gnome would have to work to trip over the bar. Troll culture consisted of individuals lurking in suitably ominous territories and killing anything that came too close. A troll's upbringing would make the School of Hard Knocks look like a preparatory academy. It was the sort of education that left gaps in a student's teeth, as well as in their knowledge.
A bad sort, said Gorm, backpedaling as fast as his tongue could carry him. At least as far as the legends are concerned. Ain't been around for ages. Even the oldest elves don't remember them.
So why worry about them if they're gone?
Asked Thane.
It's more about what they left behind, said Gorm.
The artifacts? That too,
Bert said.
Well, what else did they leave?
Thane said.
Look, Shadokin are all descended from people of light, right?
The dwarf shifted uncomfortably.
Gnolls used to be gnomes, and goblins came from dwarves, and orcs were elves, right? Well, the trolls... They were Sten.
Ah.
Thane's smile disappeared.
So you hate the Sten because of trolls?
No! Well, that's not the whole reason. Look, you ever hear of the War of Betrayal? When Manon led the Shadowkin to war?
Because he tricked and sorcerously enslaved them,
interjected Bert.
Aye, aye, not placing blame or anything, said Gorm. But when the war began, the Sten sided with the trolls. It's one reason it's called the War of Betrayal. That and all the gods stabbing each other in their metaphysical backs.
So, people hate trolls because of the Sten, then, said Thane.
Gorm and Bert winced in unison.
Well, that's not the whole reason, said the kobold.
There's also the ripping people's limbs off and eating them, said Gorm. But we know you wouldn't do that. You ain't like other trolls.
But I'm not like you either,
said Thane. He reached into a pouch hanging from his bandolier and extracted something small and purple.
What's that?
Stepping closer, Gorm saw a figurine of a knight in the troll's palm, painted all in purple and wearing a quartz crystal on its chest. It reminded Gorm of the armor old Royalheart used to wear back in the day.
Just something Caitha left out for... something she gave me.
Thane stared at the tiny statue for a moment, turning it over and over in his hands.
I've thought about what you said, about revealing my secret to her.
Gorm could tell where this was going.
Look, you can't take people's feelings about the Sten personally.
It's more the way they feel about the trolls,
said Thane.
Well, look, just because we said...
It isn't just because of what you said,
rumbled Thane.
It's because of how it's always been. From the first time I saved someone in the Mirewood, they screamed and ran away. For years, every single person I helped fled, sometimes while I was still rescuing them. It wasn't until I saved a young merchant while hidden from her that one of them spoke to me at all. But when I stepped out of the trees, she ran off as well.
Gorm started to say something, but a paw fell on his hand and stopped him. Bert looked up and shook his head. The troll stared into the distance, as though watching the past play out.
I tried every way to approach them. I was friendly, I was benign, I waited for them to invite me out of the shadows, I had entire conversations from the undergrowth before standing. None of it mattered. Sometimes they screamed, sometimes they went silent with fright, and sometimes they even shot arrows or threw spells to cover their escape. But all of them ran. And the worst part? The worst part was the way they looked at me, right before they fled.
It wasn't the arrows and spells,
said Gorm, earning himself a hard nudge from the kobold. Thane shook his head.
People make this face when they see me. Their eyes open wide and they get paler. It's all the fear and disgust they have, balled up and ready to come out as a scream. I couldn't stand to see that face, but every single time, it became easier to stay hidden.
Caitha is different,
Gorm said over Bert's pantomimed protest.
Of course she's different,
Thane laughed mirthlessly.
She's gentle and kind and powerful and beautiful, all in ways I never thought anyone could be. I wouldn't have followed you from the Mirewood if she wasn't what she is. But the people I saved were as varied as the plants of the swamp. Fighters, mages, merchants, tinkers, pilgrims, and priests. I helped all sorts, Gorm. They were all different.
The troll looked at himself in the stream.
I'm the part that doesn't change. I'm still the same. And some days you just have to wonder if they have a point, if they're right to be afraid.
Thane reached down and swiped a hand through the water, scattering his reflection.
I remained hidden for a long time, until a traveler and his wife tried to coax me out by setting a scrap of velvet on a rock as an offering. I took it when they weren't looking, and they knew I was there. They could see I was real, and they thanked me before they left. And I know it wasn't much of a connection, but it was still a connection, and one that didn't involve watching them run away or getting shot in the face.
I'm sorry.
It was hard for Gorm to argue with that logic, given his own initial meeting with Thane. Their first encounter had involved a lot of screaming, fleeing, and axe blows to the troll's head.
They must have told people what happened, because more people started setting out purple trinkets, and some began to call me the King in the Wood. I heard them tell legends about me around the cook fires.
The troll grinned at the memory, his fangs sticking out at odd angles.
and I was almost a part of their camps. Almost. The idea of me belonged, even if the rest of me didn't.
He took a deep breath before continuing.
Katha likes the idea of me, the legend she wants to be true. And if I can be that for her, if I can have that connection, I have to protect it. Because if she ever knew the reality, if I ever saw her make that terrified face...
A piercing scream split the air, startling Gorm and the Shadowkin to attention. They looked up to the top of the ridge. Laruna stood at the edge of the woods, shrieking at the top of her lungs. Thane sighed as he looked at the mage's terrified countenance.
"Yeah, that's the one,"
he said, just before the firestorm washed over him. Gerald Flynn was feeling the heat. Not in the physical sense, of course. Spring's warmth touched the Palace of Andoran last, and at this elevation it was still cold enough to see Flynn's breath in the last of dusk's light. Rather, the pressure of his job was becoming acute in a way that was really only possible for hired killers. The Tenderkin ran a sweaty palm through his hair as he glanced around pillars at the edge of the palace garden. His other hand, or more precisely, the silver mechanism that an artificer had replaced it with, wrapped its talons on the marble of a column. A shadow fell over the ground in front of the Tenderkin.
"Good evening, Flynn," said a deep voice.
Mr. Flynn tried to suppress a shudder as he leaned back against the pillar. He didn't turn around.
"Sir?"
"You've heard about Vettel?"
"Indeed, sir. A pity about the undead," said Mr. Flynn.
"King Handor will find out about the attack tomorrow," said the shadow. "I think the situation presents an opportunity."
"I've bought into several promising stocks on the news," said Flynn.
"Have you now? A good move," said the voice. "But I was asking if you had heard the rumors that Gorm Ingerson and his party reported the undead incursion."
Flynn had been expecting the subject of Gorm Ingerson to arise, but not in this manner.
"Really? But I heard it was the knight commander of Vetchel's city guard."
"I thought you had better sources, Flynn."
The voice from the shadows laughed darkly.
"I certainly hoped so, given the amount of Gilton we're paying you to make Ingerson and his companions disappear. After our last discussion, I assumed you would be the one providing information this time."
Flynn nodded.
"Yes, sir. I shall endeavor to find better sources in Ruskin."
"Do you suppose that will help?" asked the shadow. "I doubt he'll be there much longer. Ingerson does tend to pop up in random places at the most inconvenient times."
"Very unfortunate, sir."
"You have no idea, Mr. Flynn," growled the voice in the shadow. "Listen, whether they call themselves mercenaries, heroes, or assassins, there are only two types of hired killers: useful partners and loose ends."
Mr. Flynn took a deep breath. It was the second time he'd heard the loose ends speech in less than a week. That was the problem with taking on multiple contracts for the same job. The pay may have been twice as good, but the price of failure was twice as bad. And while the Tenderkin doubted that Goldson and Baggs could find an assassin skilled enough to make good on their implicit threats, some of his clients wouldn't need to find a surrogate killer. The one in the shadows always preferred a more personal touch.
"Ingerson is a loose end. I need a useful partner to get rid of him," continued the voice.
"Yes, sir."
Flynn had given the loose ends speech himself to more young assassins and would-be mercenaries than he could count. Other jobs put you on notice or gave you a performance improvement plan, but professional killers got the loose ends speech. Either way, you knew you were on the path to an early termination.
"I do hope you're a useful partner, Gerald."
"I am, sir."
"Good," said Johann the Mighty. "You are dismissed."